Agile for Humans is brought to you by Audible.com. Get one free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/agile. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland, and Crucial Conversations by Kerry Patterson. Visit www.audibletrial.com/agile to enjoy your free audiobook today.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
All right, welcome to another episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. We are still in Indianapolis at the Agile Indie Conference. Just an amazing venue, great setup, really turning into one of the better Midwest conferences. Got the opportunity to speak with Josh Karevsky. Josh, how are you? So glad you decided to join me on the show.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I feel
you.
Like I've talked to the majority of your staff at Industrial Logic. We have... You know, the listeners will remember Tim Ottinger, Arlo Belshi, a number of great agilists that work at Industrial Logic with you. But finally, you're with us. You just gave a keynote a little bit ago, so thanks for joining us after doing an hour on modern agile. I think a big question that I have, at least for the listener's sake, is, you know, when it comes to modern agile, it's a restatement of the manifesto. It's an extension of the manifesto. But what is your ultimate goal as you promote the modern agile concepts?
First of all, I'd like people to be aware that the industry, that agile itself is improving, right? So if you happen to have been taught a class or got a certification, and you know, not to say that all the classes themselves aren't useful, but there's a lot of stuff that's relatively new, and some of it's 10 years old at this point, but that's still considered new for some people, then I'd like to open their eyes to that. Really, modern agile was born out of me sort of being surprised that the people I was encountering are just still practicing very old forms of agile that we've, you know, long since retired. We've moved on to faster, better, simpler ways of working through experimentation, through just simple, just trying stuff. It's not just us, like continuous deployment was not a thing, you know, 15 years ago. No one was doing that. I mean, maybe there are some shops in the world that were doing it, but for the large majority of practitioners, no one, that wasn't the term. You know, we were doing continuous integration. So if you don't look at continuous deployment or continuous delivery and say, wow, this is something that we could get our heads around and maybe do, that's one of many things you could be doing to really up your game, right? So what I'm trying to do is, what I've always been trying to do, is help people and teams and companies get a whole lot better at the outcomes they're going for. Agile has been, you know, the umbrella term for many different ways of working. So modern agile is really just, I think modern means you're always modernizing. You're always looking for a better way. And hey, it could be, I'm gonna take something from 30 years ago that, you know, was very, very useful. Let's say it's wideband Delphi estimation technique. I think Dan North recently wrote something about blink estimation, which is very similar. And it's like, okay, cool, this is a really good technique. Maybe it could help us go faster than we do today. Let's use it. Let's try it. Let's experiment with it. Let's constantly experiment with our process to be better and better and better. And that's the essence of why I call it modern. Modernizing, always looking to improve.
So there's aspects to it. There's four quadrants that you have, or four sections. One of them is that experimentation. And I have a concern. I haven't talked about this publicly. I think you're the perfect person to breach this, and hopefully the listeners create a little safety to talk about this. But experimentation to me runs counter to a lot of the certification bodies out there right now. Mm-hmm. And my concern is when you have like the Scrum Guide, mm-hmm. and then you have trainers, and then you have offerings, or even you have agile courses, mm-hmm. and you have this dogma that has to stay static, mm-hmm. or else there's tremendous expense
yeah.
to changing the narrative. And
right.
I'm wondering if we got away from that message of experimentation through this building up of an industry, mm-hmm. Of training, certification, offerings. And is this a way, at least in some extent, to just get back to the idea that even Agile is supposed to be inspected and adapted? Like, we're supposed to be
yeah.
always evolving these practices and thoughts, and perhaps breaking away from some of those challenges that some of the industrial aspects of Agile have brought forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, that phrase inspect and adapt, you know, it's probably one of the most underused principles or sayings from Scrum. Places tend to get mired in the rituals and don't necessarily practice inspect and adapt, right? So, you know, it is built in to things like Scrum, and Extreme Programming had this as well, but they were just not emphasized enough. With Eric Ries really turning Lean Startup into the concept of experiments and scientific method and all of that really changed the game, and making sure you treat your requirements as guesses that you need to experiment with as inexpensively and as rapidly as possible. So, you know, I think there's these opposing forces, which is that more and more people and companies want to become agile,
right?
Or as they say, do agile. And which do right off the bat, if they say do agile, they mean like what are the five steps I follow, versus how do I become agile, and how do I continue to get more agile? So there's this competing, because there's like all these companies want to take advantage of it, especially when you got Harvard Business Review coming up and saying, you know, everyone's going agile.
Right.
You know, every company's looking around going, how about us? You know, so the concept of scaling needs to be there, you know, because you need to. I gave a speech, many years ago now at the Big Agile Conference. This was in Calgary at the time. I called it Commoditizing Agility. And it was the kind of title that could, you know, bother people maybe, because the concept of commoditization usually connotates something bad.
Sure.
For a lot of people. Oh, that's been commoditized. But if you actually really study commoditization, it can be very, very good, or it can be very bad. Right? Like let's talk about like a J unit. You know,
sure.
it's a commodity, you know, it's free, you use it, if you modify JUnit so that, you know, it has special things for you specifically, and then a new version comes out, you can't actually use the new version because you're already locked into your version, guess what? You've decommoditized a commodity. and so commodities are you can build on top of commodities, right?
Sure.
Harley Davidson is known for being incredibly good at customizing motorcycles from commoditized parts and pieces. So I was interested in commoditizing agility by making really impactful e-learning that could teach people skills. I mean, it's big aspirational stuff. How could we teach people skills to be really, really good at something like refactoring without being there?
Right.
And that was the goal. I don't think you can ever really achieve that goal, but you try. Because then it could be, if that worked, you could spread that across thousands and thousands of people, and suddenly if they went through this thing, they'd be very skilled. That's the idea, to me, of good commoditization.
Right.
What we ended up with a lot of the certifications is a commoditization of, you know, this sort of two-day sheep dipping approach, which isn't an ongoing, you know, learning model. It's very superficial. It's not like targeted one little practice like we were trying to do with e-learning. And I say trying, we succeeded. We've hit, you know, thousands of people have studied from our stuff. So yeah, how do you deal with the large scale of people wanting to become agile versus ossifying the practice? Right, because things change, you get better, you learn, oh, that old way, there's a better way to do it now. So I think the best companies remain, the best people, the best companies remain lifelong learners, You know, there's the book, Peter Senge's book, The Learning Organization.
Sure.
The Fifth Element, which is about the learning organization.
So continuous learning certainly plays into it. It's one of those that I tend to agree that if you're not inspecting, adapting, learning almost continually, you know, back to there was a keynote this morning about companies that don't follow that will be gone in 7 years. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2020, the bar will be so high that if you're not learning continually, your company won't make it past the 7 year mark.
Yeah.
And they're saying that that's been on an accelerated path. You know, back in the 30s, a company could expect to last 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 50s, it shrunk down to 30, and that just, it's an exponential line going.
Right.
And I find it interesting that while there is that, I think that's almost accepted now. I don't think anyone's arguing against that, but are you seeing the kind of investment in continuous learning at these large Fortune 1,000, 500, 50, 10, whatever size that you pick? Mm-hmm. Are you actually seeing that kind of investment now?
I am. The smart companies are definitely getting much more experimental.
Sure.
They are actually putting real money into experiments, trying things out. I'm seeing it's getting better and better. It really is. It's absolutely critical for this to occur. So things are shifting. I think the competitive pressures are such now that people really realize they've got to experiment, and they have to create a culture that allows for failure to occur, I mean, safe failure, the way I mentioned in the keynote Amazon does, treating the entire environment like a venture capital fund, from which you expect there to be failures, and you know that the successes are going to easily pay for the failures. So, you know, set up as many things as you can, expect failures, and it's okay.
Yeah, I think the problem that some companies haven't grabbed onto yet is that the alternative, like, so if you're not going to set up the learning organization and continual learning, you're just going to get disrupted.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I mean, that's just the cab industry. Mm-hmm. Never saw Uber coming.
Right.
Rideshare was thought as just unsafe, crazy.
Yeah.
They just push that to the side. Now suddenly, at least in Chicago, everyone's got the Uber app out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Uber's had some missteps lately. I think they'll get through it, or maybe Lyft will disrupt them.
Yeah.
But in any case, the cab is the last resort now, and I don't think anyone would have thought that as short as, what, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, saw it with Blockbuster, same type of
right.
thing. They're resting on their laurels. They're not realizing that they need to try to put themselves out of business. This is the standard business wisdom is,
sure.
What can you do to put yourself out of business? Because you better start doing that.
Right.
That's real safety. That's making safety a prerequisite is to approach it like that. Andy Grove, you know, only the paranoid survive. From Intel, you know, that's the companies that really get ahead are constantly. Amazon is like saying, look, even before the customers ask us for something that is even cooler than what we provide, we're already working on it, thinking they're going to be like, oh yeah, that really cool thing they did. Now it's like, ho hum, whatever, we're used to it. What's even better? You know, like, oh, well, I'll deliver you something in 30 minutes. Like, you know, and again, you're not asking for it, but they know you want it.
Eventually, we will want it, right?
Right.
So it's coming.
Right.
You've mentioned the word safety a few times, and actually, this is what I mean. You know, Tim Oniger's a friend already. I love talking to him on the podcast. He's on quite a bit. But when he started introducing me to Modern Agile, and he said that you guys have made safety a prerequisite, I instantly bought in, and I think this is actually. I hope this is actually the pillar. Or the section that people come back to years from now and say, this is what put us into the next phase.
Yeah.
Can you just go into, I mean, when people hear safety, I think they hear a lot of, there's physical safety, psychological safety, organizational safety. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of different types of safety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you after with making safety a prerequisite? How do you see that in companies? And really, you know, where does it actually take us to that next level?
Yeah, so, I think the light bulb moment for me with safety was with reading about Paul O'Neill's work at Alcoa, and this was in the book The Power of Habit. So if you read that book, it's a New York Times bestselling book by Charles Duhigg. The story is phenomenal. I mean, Paul became CEO of a 100-year-old company, Yeah. You know, by 1986, it was 100 years old. And I don't want to give it all away, but long story short, he made worker safety his thing, the main, it wasn't a priority either, because priorities shift. He made safety a prerequisite at Alcoa. He said, he went around to every factory. He said, look, if you find something unsafe, fix it. Don't wait till next year's budget. I'll figure out a way to pay for it. The workers, everything transformed there. I mean, it just blossomed. And, you know, you could also look at this as a way of saying, how did you make them self-organize or give them autonomy? Well, now they had the autonomy to make their own work environment safer. This led them to be more valued and feel more valued. This led them to be more innovative. So innovation flourished there. The union stopped fighting because now they realized they had a guy looking after their people. So suddenly they could do a 7-year deal instead of banging heads every year on the union contract. Quality got better. Everything improved. And steadily the injuries went down. They were already acceptable when he joined. I mean, they were at acceptable levels for OSHA, you know, the Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration. But they kept going down and down and down, and revenue just kept going up and up and up. And so it's an amazing story of changing a 100-year-old company. And he was there for, Polonia was there for 13 years. And when he left, the trends continued. So he really transformed it, not just like, oh, the inspirational leader leaves and it goes back to what it was. No, that he changed the DNA of a 100-year-old company. So that blew my mind, and I started really thinking deeply about safety. And of course, I realized, hey, safety is in what we do in Agile. I mean, you could look at extreme programming and find all kinds of safety in there. Well, we were never really talking about it explicitly. And so when we started to talk about it explicitly, it became clear, you know, there's financial safety. I love what Lean Startup talks about, is like rapidly invalidating an idea instead of just building it first and then seeing if anyone wants it. Well, why don't we just, what's the fastest, cheapest, quickest way we can invalidate the idea so we don't even have to build it, potentially? That's financial safety. You know, you're saving time, you're saving money, really important to businesses. Then there's like reputational stuff, right? I remember we, you know, once sold some of our e-learning to a customer, and that customer didn't end up using it much. It was just, they're too busy and didn't get used. I felt so bad for that purchaser because she got a kind of, you know, bad eye, black eye, if you will, for that particular purchase, because here she bought some shelfware. That made me feel bad for her. We weren't protecting her. So there's that level of safety there. There's the safety on the team, you know, being able to have difficult conversations, that famous book, Difficult Conversations, or how to work in a psychologically safe environment, as you said. You know, these things don't come easy. It takes some training, it takes some work to learn how to be safe psychologically. What Paul O'Neill would say too is that Alcoa, if there was an injury, they would get to the bottom of it, they'd come up with a solution for it, and then they didn't just fix it at that factory. They fixed it at all of their factories worldwide. I forget how many there were, but maybe 340 at the time. But I mean, they was like, we don't want this problem to ever occur in any one of our factories. So we're going to spend time getting the message out, fixing it. And he said, this was our competitive advantage, that they went, that other companies couldn't do that as well. So they learned from a mistake, and they deployed that learning organization-wide. You're talking a big organization, big worldwide organization. So it was just utterly inspirational to me. And I thought, wow, safety really is the keystone habit to excellence. The only trouble is that people don't really care about safety for the most part. They want it to be there, but it's not like they go out and say, I want to buy safety. You know, when you buy a phone, you're not like, that's the safest phone on the market. No, it's like, well, I like the way it looks. I like the way it feels. I like the plan I get with it. Now, if someone robs your data from that phone, right, you don't feel too safe, and maybe you'd never get that phone again. But that's usually an afterthought.
Or unless it's a Galaxy Note S7, right?
Right, that it blows up
in your pocket. Suddenly you wanted to be safe. But no, I think what it did for me, it was a light bulb moment to where I thought, finally someone is making the cultural shift explicit.
Yeah.
Like, because you can read the manifesto and there are people who would argue there's no management lessons in the principles. That's just for developers. It was a developer play. It was 17 devs, you know, at a ski lodge.
Yeah.
You know, which I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's deep insights all over the place if you just read it, mm-hmm. internalize it, you know, spend years thinking about those things.
Sure.
But what you've done, I think, is actually you've taken that cultural shift and said, this is part of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're not going to do this, it's not agile. And that's a pretty wide and deep stake to put in the ground.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's been, or maybe I should just ask instead of assume. I mean, has there been some blowback from some of the things that you've tried to put out there, and where are you seeing some of the resistance?
No, I mean, mostly it's very, very positive. People are, they find that describing Agile via the four modern Agile principles, I sometimes call them imperatives, the four imperatives, because I think that they're imperative for real success. I very little criticism of those. I mean, some people think I'm trying to just one-up the manifesto, and that's really not the case at all. I never set out to do that. I wrote a blog. Carl Scotland in the UK said, you know, actually those four circles in the diagram with all this other stuff, those four seem like the most important parts. And that he related them to the manifesto's values. And I thought, you know, Carl's got a pretty good idea here. These four principles really do relate to the original manifesto values, but kind of take it in a different direction. The Make People Awesome one is one of my favorites because I don't think Agile, as I said in the keynote today, I don't think Agile ever really stated what we wanted to accomplish. It's like that was always upstream. You know, work in an Agile way, but the people upstream are going to tell you what to work on. And I think with Lean Startup, and I think with what we've been doing with Modern Agile is saying, you know, actually we need a direction, because imagine being really Agile and slamming into a wall. Right? You wouldn't say that's very agile. You were agile up to the point when you hit the wall, but then you hit the wall and you look like a kind of doofus. You know, that's not that agile. You got to know where you're going. You got to know what you're trying to achieve. And that's what Make People Awesome is about. I think Kathy Sierra, you know, nailed it when she said, let's focus on making users badass at whatever they do, if it's accounting or balancing the checkbook or making a beautiful photograph. Let's focus on them. Modern Agile says, yeah, let's focus on them and also on the rest of the crew we work with, our teammates and our managers and stakeholders. Let's focus on making them awesome. So that's a very clear direction. So it is, you know, trying to move in that way. And then the experiment, learn rapidly, and deliver value continuously are kind of like how you get there. What do you actually do?
But what also is interesting about the Make People Awesome, it seems like there's the concept of obliquity, which I'm sure you're familiar with, where you're attacking a problem from a different angle. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if a company were to just state as a core value, making people awesome is what we do.
Yeah.
It seems like those other items just flow. Mm-hmm. But that's so counterintuitive in a lot of these big companies. What I have seen, and I think Modern Agile and the influence of you and Tim and Arlo, you know, spreading this message, and many others. I know Bill Wake. I mean, you've got some of the top people at Industrial Logic pushing this idea. And what I'm starting to see is that that language is entering companies.
And
it's really fascinating to see where the focus on the employee. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they realize that they're creating safety or they're just trying to do the right thing, or however they wrap it, there are actually studies coming out. There's case reports coming out from these companies where we focused on people, mm-hmm. and suddenly our profits went up.
Right.
And they're trying to like connect those dots, and we're not even going to worry about the science or the math. Just keep focusing on that.
Yep.
So it really is. It is a real thing. It's something that I'm very appreciative that you've brought forward and through your work and your company's work.
Yeah.
I know that we get a lot of great reception to these ideas on the podcast, so just want to say thank you for that.
My pleasure.
And
pleasure. Yeah. It's again, to modernagile.org, so there are other companies besides Industrial Logic that are interested and that are moving it forward. They're, you know, bringing it into their companies and evolving things for it. So I'm excited for the future of it. I'm trying to keep it as a .org, you know, so it's meant to be guided by a whole bunch of different people. And
well, I think that's an important point that doesn't get brought up often enough, is that this is an idea that you've made free to the world.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to sit through a 2-day course to get the the modern Agile vibe. It's here's an idea.
Yeah.
Let's discuss it and run with it, which is another great, you know, the .org has been a great gift to the community as well.
Yeah, thanks. But I you know, what I have found too is it does take some training to get folks to really understand what this means. A lot of people don't, they love say, you know, here's my critique of it. I can't just work from the principles. You've got to give me some idea of what to do.
Sure.
You know, so we're working on that. We have workshops we do teach. We don't really, you know, go around saying, you know, come to my $5,000 a day class. But we do teach them, and we're always refining how we teach. But it's modern Agile, again, is not just for IT. Really, like I said in the keynote, I mean, here's an example from a 3-star Michelin restaurant, or here's an example from, you know, when I started blogging, or video blogging on YouTube, you know, get some equipment. What's the first thing you do if you're an Agilist, you know, when you have a bunch of equipment? You know, I'm sure.
What's the first thing I do with a bunch of equipment?
Yeah, you're gonna make a podcast, but you got all this new equipment. What do?
I just give it a shot and see how it's going to sound. I hook up the minimum that I need going. Like right now, we're on a laptop and a very inexpensive USB microphone.
Right, but you might make a 10-second show first and see how it sounds.
Yep.
Run it all the way through. That's a walking skeleton. That's evolutionary design. That's you're making safety a prerequisite, because why record an entire show if you haven't tested that the stuff works correctly, right?
And you're right. I have test recordings here to make sure that this was going to go fine.
Right.
So I'm totally right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just see those principles applying to a variety of things, not just software. I think that's an important point, too, of modern Agile, is we're seeing this. And it can sound, oh, wow, he's so grandiose. He's trying to go outside of. But, boy, we've seen our own clients say, hey, how do I apply this to my hardware team? You know, we've worked with hardware teams to help them.
Sure.
And they're like, what are you doing? You're a software person. Why are you talking to the mechanical engineer and the electrical engineer? But it's like, you know, it's the same. CI, continuous integration, applies to you as much as it does to software developers. It's slightly different, but, you know, you guys have to integrate at some point. So maybe try integrating earlier.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's, I see a lot of use of it in other areas.
So I know we've got a hard stop. I want to be respectful of that. So this great discussion. I really appreciate you doing this. Wanted to give you a quick opportunity. You know, everyone that comes on the show gets a space at the end. Anything you'd like to promote? Anything that you'd like to get listeners in front of? Any ways that they can interact, whether it's Twitter, LinkedIn, anything like that? So the floor is yours. Anything you'd like to talk about? Would love to hear it.
Yeah, I'm Joshua Kariewski. That's Kereivsky on Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook and other places. I'm giving a lot of speeches around the world, so that's a bunch of things coming up: Germany and Prague and Toronto and a bunch of them, Australia. So I'll be speaking a lot of places. You know, I love it if people join the Modern Agile community, ask questions, learn more, go to modernagile.org, go to the community section, and you can find one of our groups, like the Slack community or the Facebook community. And we'd be delighted to have you learn more. There's, if you want stickers, you can get them there at it's not no cost, but it's no profit. We just sell them for what we get them. I appreciate the chance to talk to you today, Ryan.
Yeah, well, thanks for doing this. We caught Josh right after his keynote, so he spoke for an hour and then was gracious enough to do this. So thank you again for doing this.
Pleasure.
And we'll get links to your upcoming talks, the community, all the books that we talked about. We'll make sure that gets in the show notes so that listeners can dig in more. There's a lot of great reference material here, so I hope everyone takes advantage of it. So Josh, thanks again. Really enjoyed this.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.